Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, a podcast for teachers of physics, made by physics teachers. Episode 50, the Big 5-0. Yes, my name is Thomas WP, a part-time A-level mostly physics teacher, and I'm joined today by Robin Griffiths.
Hello, happy new year to you, Thomas, and also we are joined by Patrick Caplow, all the way from America.
Yeah, Windham, New Hampshire, happy new year as well.
Happy New Year to you. And first thing I was going to ask is, do you have any New Year's resolutions?
No. That's always a good one. I don't like the principle of New Year's resolutions generally, because I tend to find it sort of setting yourself up for a fall. But in teaching terms, I think, you know, a new terms resolution is no bad thing. You know, sort of thinking about how your teacher's gone once you've had a break and thinking about new things to do. I was thinking that, probably when I go back to the classroom, what will I try and do? Well, inspired a bit by the podcast, I think I will try to make my practicals a little bit more assessed, if that makes sense, so that kids, when they're doing the practicals, are knowing what sort of theory they're supposed to be leaning on, and then that I focus on getting some sort of way of assessing how much they've got from it afterwards. So, you know, that there's a little follow-up question or an activity that they have to do that will reveal to me how much they've understood from their practical work.
Nice.
That's my New Year's resolution.
Nice. Hmm. Patrick?
Yeah, I'm not sure. So my classroom New Year's resolution involves also a different take on assessment, but I'm not sure it would interest your UK listeners, because it involves, you know, essentially my attitudes towards the test itself after a particular unit and letting the students keep that. Usually I recollect it and kind of recycle tests from year to year, but I've started building second and third kind of versions of tests, and so my thoughts are that students will use them to study from, and then of course that will position them better to do a reassessment or a cumulative assessment at the end of the semester.
Nice.
How very teacherly of you. I have a teacherly one too, funnily enough. I you introduced me to plickers, Robin, and my resolution is to use plickers 3 times before half term. I'm at low bar, I know, but I wish to try that. Because it does look interesting.
Yeah, I've actually shelled out and paid for a subscription to it now, which is interesting. Because now I get the reporting, and what it does is, once you do enough of these, you start to get a picture of which kids are struggling with which concepts, because you can get it all broken down by individual and things like that. So I get effectively a score sheet out of Plickers that tells me who's doing what and who's getting what's going over and who's struggling with certain concepts.
The podcast sponsored by Plickers.
it could be. I mean, I'm a big fan. I like it because it does what I was saying earlier about the practicals, the assessment side of things, of actually finding out how much they've learned and retained. I found it really useful for that.
When I spoke to someone at school about it, they were laughing. They're saying, you know, the school did a big push on this 2 years ago. It never took hold. Don't mention that to X in the staff. So I went to see him. I wonder if we have a subscription. I haven't quite worked that out yet. But it is a very interesting tool for people who haven't heard of it. Plickers, is it Plickers?
That's it. That's the one. And Plickers.com is the website. But it's, I do love that. You know, the school did a big push on it 2 years ago. I had no idea. It's all of the teachers in charge of professional development in schools who are listening just keeled over. No,
sorry.
It's so true. It's what happens, isn't it? You get busy and you miss these things.
Now we can use Plickers in April, couldn't we? In our exciting event that we're going to.
This is so exciting.
We are.
I know, this is great.
We are going to Boston. Podcast live in Boston. Maybe we could take Plickers to survey our audience, because it'll no doubt be massive.
Absolutely. And it is. It's the podcast is going on tour. I'm going to get T-shirts made up. It's obviously only have one date on the back, but it will be good. But yeah, we're off to, now it's the North American Science Teachers Association Conference. Is that right, Patrick?
National Science Teachers Association. So NSTA, and they have a conference usually in the spring and the fall. And so this is the spring conference in Boston. They changed the city. And the last time I was there, I mean, I think it was honestly like 2012. I mean, it's been a while.
So this is kind of like when the Beatles played Yankee Stadium or whatever it was, I guess. It's kind of, you know, the podcast Conquering America, that kind of thing.
I'm sure it's like it. Yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly like it. There we go. So it will be great.
So egged on by Patrick, we applied to present there, and we're doing a podcast. We're doing a event called Podcasting and Professionalism, a British Twist.
Yeah,
and I think what we decided, we're going to do a rundown of our top 10 things we've learned. A lot of them will be practical, but we're definitely going to demo the vacuum cannon and talk about how we got started and wear bowler hats, I think. Is that what you want, Patrick? Because you think we'd podcast in bowler hats, I think you said.
No, I just think that the American teachers will appreciate the British flavor. So it doesn't have to be bowler hats, but maybe a break for tea and something like that.
No, I think we'll be there like Thompson and Thompson out of Tintin. That'll be... Yes, we'll have the little umbrellas, walking sticks, bowler hats, big bushy moustaches. Oh, yeah, we'd hate to disappoint. But obviously, if you are in and around Boston at any time in April, usually you just sit there and go, NSTA conference. There's never anything on, but now there is. Get yourself a ticket now to avoid disappointment.
Now, my wife does a lot of sewing meetups, and she's gone to America for one. Maybe we should have a physics teaching podcast meetup in a pub in Boston. And maybe it'll just be the three of us, or maybe it'll be four. But we'll organise that nearer the time.
Yeah.
I'm so excited about this.
Now, also, so one of the big success stories of the podcast generally has been the vacuum cannon, right? So yeah. we're taking the vacuum cannon on the road with us, if US customs will allow. So what is this? It's a cannon. We're going to do that at the event. So I guess the vacuum cannon is great. But you've had some feedback on this, Thomas, haven't you?
We have had some feedback. In fact, we went to the Dulwich conference before Christmas. And I ran into Jonathan Shaw, friend of the podcast. Hi, Jonathan. And he had a good question about the vacuum cannon. I'm here at the Dulwich Physics Conference with Jonathan Shaw, who has an interesting observation about the vacuum cannon that we might put to Patrick Caplow.
Vacuum cannon, fantastic. Thank you very much, Thomas, and the Physics Teaching Podcast. But what would be fantastic for me is five best things to do with it. So how do you measure muscle velocity? Different options and other things to do with it.
Okay, so five practical things we can do with a vacuum cannon. I would guess this is... My number one would just be fire it, because it's thrilling to fire it and see that ball, or not see that ball, whiz across the room and shatter against the wall. Or in my case, recently just bounce off the wall because the cannon didn't fire super fast. It was still impressive. But how do you measure muzzle velocity for a start, Patrick?
Well, first, I agree with you that just firing the cannon is a whole lot of fun, and it just generates so much student interest into what's happening. How it works, what are the physics involved, what's the physics involved. I would get into that, I would say, hey, if you just fire it against the wall, you almost can't see anything. Have you guys experienced that?
Yeah, sure.
I've found that like an empty aluminum can is a great target for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's got just about the right mass so when the ball hits it, the can will fly against the far wall, but you'll be able to see it. But it moves so quickly, you get a sense for how much kind of power we're dealing with. And it also dents the can in a way that's truly impressive for anybody watching. So I'd recommend checking that out. I've actually taken a full seltzer can, shaken it up a bit and taped it and secured it with meter rulers and clamps and duct tape to the desk. And if you shake it up, you know, as close as you can before firing, the decrease in volume causes the corresponding increase in pressure. Of course, there's a little bit of a chemistry lesson there, and the can will just burst, and not it'll burst catastrophically. I mean, it rips open. So there's just some fun visual demos to do. I wouldn't recommend soda because the whole classroom will be sticky afterwards.
I was going to say, what's the blast radius of the fizzy water?
Jeez, I usually have students, you know, 5 meters away, maybe. I mean, it's significant, but it's just, you know, seltzer water. And the aluminum can rips, it doesn't shatter.
Mm.
So that's three things. Fire it at an empty can, fire it at a shaken up soda can, and we haven't got to muzzle velocity,
right,
have we?
Right. So you can get a ball to go straight through an empty can. If you secure the can to the table, top and bottom, you can get the ball to go in and then out the other side of the can, which is
okay, fun. So we're going to have five things just for the can at this rate. I have fired it at a can. It does shoot across the room and hit the wall. I haven't fired it at a taped down can. If it goes straight through, that would be something to see.
Have you tried to put a slow-mo camera on it, Patrick, at all, so that you can track the ball going through the can?
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing I was thinking. Is it too fast even to be picked up by a slow-mo camera?
So I think when slow-mo became a new feature on phone cameras maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, I think it was 120 frames per second. We took some images and yeah, it's cool, but not that cool because it's going so fast. If you don't hit something first, you'll only get a few frames of the ball. You're lucky.
I filmed it from behind with the 120 frames a second camera and in a big room. So about 14 meters, I think I measured it as, and that you see the ball, you can't see the ball really the naked eye, but with the film, you do get a beautiful. It goes obviously in a curve. It can't fly straight because it's not rifled. It you do see the curve, but that's all you see. But firing it across a big room, if you get everyone behind it, that's a lot of fun as well because it's still, the speed doesn't drop off that fast and it's hard to follow with the naked eye. So muzzle velocity.
Muzzle velocity, lest we forget muzzle velocity. But so I saw a demo of a vacuum cannon where they'd done something clever, and I was trying to remember what it was that they did. I think they used a microphone, so they put up a plywood screen for the ball to hit about a meter from the front of the cannon, and then they had a microphone right above it, and then they had a light gate, or did they use a piece of tinfoil to make a circuit break. I can't remember, but they basically had both of them feeding into an oscilloscope so you could see the two peaks, you know, a certain distance apart, and they worked it that way. So that was one of the ones I saw, which I thought was quite clever because it was engineering a way around the problem, because most of the traditional ways are quite hard. Or you can do some indirect measurement, which I think actually for me is even more fun, like we tried, Thomas, when we tried to make a drinks carton or something.
Yeah, that did work well, but I wondered later about the aerodynamics of the carton. So what we did, Patrick, was that we had a 1 litre, what would you have, 16 ounce, we have a 1 litre drinks carton, and we emptied it out, filled it with tissue paper and weighed it, and then we balanced it, rested it on two lovely round felt tips that Robin had, so it rolled really, really freely right in front of the muzzle. And we measured its height off the table. It was right on the edge of the table. And then we fired the gun. And we knew how long it would take to hit the ground just using kinematics and the height. And we knew how far away it landed because we watched it and measured it. And that gave us a figure that was less than the speed of sound. And it was it was sort of in the 200s. I can't remember. It's a while ago now. It worked really well. I just wonder if it had lift.
Think about how much physics is involved in what you just said.
Yeah, exactly. It's superb.
It's incredible. It's a great thing. I one of the things I love is that usually when you're doing momentum, which at least in my opinion I find to be the most applicable place to do a lot of these exercises, but then you kind of review prior knowledge. You activate prior knowledge and say, okay, to your point about a horizontally fired projectile, that's knowledge that you need to retain. So it's great to reapply it in this case. How about the same exact thing, a drinks carton, except attached to the top of a wooden block, and the block slides, let's say, half a meter. Now you have some work and energy involved, or you could just assess the frictional coefficient between the block and the surface of the table and kind of work backwards there. If you know the kinetic coefficient of friction, which you could, you know, again, is a completely separate from momentum, you know, branch of or part of physics, then you could figure out how fast it was going just after impact.
That's nice. That's another nice way of extending it's just a way of bringing the vacuum cannon into yet another consideration, isn't it, of friction and coefficient of friction and kinetic energy. And yeah, it's nice. So when you were talking about that, Patrick, I was thinking, or you could tilt a ramp, so you have something around, you could tilt it so that it counteracts the friction, and then you could measure the speed of a 1 kilo kinematics trolley with its milk carton attached to the top as it went down the ramp, and then you'd have the kinetic energy that has been transferred to the trolley, wouldn't you?
Right.
Okay, so...
all these... I tried using a ballistics pendulum, but it didn't work too well because I kind of worked out if it was going 200 meters a second, how high the pendulum would swing and therefore how heavy the pendulum would have to be. And I didn't think about inertia. I just chucked a few. It was another milk carton. I just chucked a few 1 newton weights in there. Of course, the carton shot backwards and the weights hit the floor. They stayed where they were.
Oh, dear.
The carton hit the ceiling. I mean, it was just... and the thing is, it's not consistent when it fires, is it? Because it can misfire. And when it goes, it really goes. And it's being consistent about how you load it.
So we've got some there, haven't we? So we've got the milk carton with the which is the way we did it, milk carton flying off the table, and you do basically a projectile calculation on it. And then we had the idea of it going and hitting a trolley, and you've already worked out the coefficient of friction, and you can work backwards to the speed of the ping pong ball off the back of that. And then we've had a slight variation on that with a tipped ramp, but also a ballistic pendulum as well. So that's loads of different ways. And of course, there was the way that I saw, which was just using an oscilloscope to try and capture two events: the event as it leaves the muzzle, and the event as it hits something a meter later. So loads of really interesting ways. And you could set this as a challenge, couldn't you? I mean, this, you know, Patrick, I'm going to defer to you here because you are Mr. Challenge Lab, but you could set that as a challenge for the students, right?
Well, I think one of the difficulties in creating a challenge lab with this apparatus is that, to Thomas's point earlier, it is inconsistent. Sometimes it really goes. Sometimes the seals give you a great differential pressure across the ball. Sometimes they don't. A small... aberration on the inside surface of the pipe could introduce friction that wasn't, you know, accounted for. So I think it's hard to say, hey, you know, let's turn this into a percent error. If your percent error is, you know, less than this number, but we don't really know how fast the actual muzzle velocity was. One thing I would add is whatever method that you choose to assess the muzzle velocity, I think one fun exercise to do with students before that is to predict the maximum theoretical muzzle velocity simply using the difference in pressure across the ball. So let's, you know, assume perfect vacuum on one side of the ball and you know, atmospheric pressure on the other side of the ball. We know the cross-sectional area of the ball, so we can determine the force on the ball. We know the mass of the ball, so we know the acceleration of the ball. You know the length of the pipe. So you should be able to figure out what the maximum theoretical, if all conditions were perfect, and then compare that to the, you know, experimental muzzle velocity. Now, of course, you get this, you know, significant difference, and then asking students to attribute, you know, those differences. What factors affect this lower number?
Yeah, good. That's nice.
So reading between the lines, it sounds like do anything with the vacuum cannon, and there's a load of physics in it that isn't just about a vacuum. There's so much kinematics in there. There's so many ways you can calculate things from the vacuum cannon. It's just a great tool. If you got it, use it, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is, can I leave a philosophical question hanging?
Sure.
Is it still the speed of sound if there's no air in the pipe? Because surely the speed of sound that we quote, 340
it's
meters.
It's not. I don't think that's philosophical. It's not. Patrick and I have talked about this before. It's just a velocity that at sea level under normal air pressure is the speed of sound. But obviously it's not as it comes out of the muzzle because there's no air there.
Do you see? This is why I love physicists. It's why I love physicists, because they answer rhetorical questions. Yeah. Is it the case that... Yes, it is.
Well, I'm very literal, you know that. Anyway, to the all but 20 people of the listening to the podcast who haven't got a vacuum cannon, let's cover something else about physics that came out of Dulwich. I had an excellent chat with Dr. Ben Still. Ben has written a brilliant book, Particle Physics, Brick by Brick. He actually came to my school to talk about it, which is really fascinating. He talked about energy in a way that really fascinated me, and I wanted to share it with you and get your point of view. The second thing I wanted to ask you is something you said about in physics, everything just wants to reduce its energy. Mm-hmm. And I find that enlightening. I've not taught in that way before. I just wondered if you could expand on that idea as well. You showed a diagram of a proton and an electron, and they fell down an energy well and met at the bottom.
Yeah, I think it's a powerful message which runs through all of physics, is just the minimization of energy. It happens across the entire universe. It happens with any force, any interaction. And it's something which, you know, can come up in every single part of even just the GCSE course, from electricity to energy itself, but also some of the other mechanics and everything. Because forces are inextricably linked to potential energies, because a potential energy is just the position of an object within a particular force field. And the reason that energy was essentially, the idea of potential energy came about was to explain the forces that we experience in experiments. So the forces are the manifestation of this attempt at reaching minimal energy, and everything will tend towards a minimum in energy wherever they are, whatever that minimum might be. And the minimum is defined by the local environment. And so, as you said, between those two opposite charge particles, there will naturally be a gully of there will be a valley of potential between the two, which means that they themselves, those particles, are actually at a higher potential energy than is possible, and so they just naturally transform into the lower potential energy, which brings them naturally together. So the force is a result of the gradient of the potential.
I think I need to reteach my electric and gravitational fields units for my whole career. I mean, I've obviously taught about potential and lifting things out the potential, but I've never taught about it in this idea of everything trying to come back to get to the lowest potential possible, and putting that across all the physics where there's a force involved. We've certainly taught in the podcast about energy as the accounting for forces, and the new energy model. You told me it's 30 years old, but the model that's been now being pushed by the IOP about stores and transfers. And even that, does that model teach us that energies, we're not trying, but things want to get to the lowest energy level? It just tells us what happens, doesn't it, that the stores and transfers. It doesn't tell us that. Does it tell us the direction?
I suppose it does.
I think in terms of stores and transfers, I tend to try and teach from the model that there are only two types of store: potential and kinetic. And then we break down the idea that potential is to do with the position within a force field, and then students name a bunch of forces, and essentially those forces have an associated potential energy with them. And then breaking down further the electrostatic potential or electric potential into chemical potential, elastic potential, and talking about the fact that it's just changing the positions of electrons within bonds, but it's all one and really the same kind of thing.
It's still a field. It's still a charge and a field.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And from that, I try and then go to students' picture of a field, the magnetic field, and the idea that field lines want to be as spaced apart as possible. But if you were somehow able to manipulate the shape of the field, it would want to return to its original shape. The field itself is elastic, and it wants to be as evenly distributed as possible. And so if you brought another magnet towards another magnet, you would be changing the shape of the field, and therefore you would be changing the energy of that field. Because it can be complicated when talking about potential energies, because, you know, the one misconception that I try and bust from square one is, where is the energy stored in a pen if you lift it off of a desk? Of course, some students will think it's in the pen, but it's not. It's in the field. Yeah. Strictly speaking, it's in the shape change of the field. All that's going to happen is it's going to want to become as evenly distributed as possible. And then the way in which it achieves that is by essentially exerting forces to bring things to a lower potential.
So my question is, you two pure physicists with physics degrees, speaking as a half engineer, is that any of that new to you, or is it just, for me, it's reductionism, not reductionism, it's deconstruction of physics into a really simple idea that everything wants to fall, and there's only two types of stored energy, movement and field shape change. I mean, that's, for me, that clarity of thinking is incredibly useful, but I just wanted to know what you thought, Patrick. You're both physics graduates, aren't you? So what do you think, Patrick?
Well, first of all, I am a mechanical engineer by training, so I am not a physicist. I certainly think the clarity of the conceptual model that he's built would certainly advantage students, and seeing and hearing explanations for phenomena from different angles is always a benefit. So I don't know if it's the only way to explain it, but it certainly is a nice kind of secondary, or maybe it's the primary way to explain the phenomena. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think I've heard the idea of everything reducing energy. I think I've heard from the entropy point of view, which is the principle that the reason everything is going to a lower state of energy is because the more dispersed energy is through the universe, the greater the entropy, and everything's moving to a state overall of greater entropy. So it's not entirely new to me, but I've heard it in the context of thermodynamics slightly more widely. That's familiar. The idea of reducing every type of energy store to one of two types, it's either potential or it's kinetic, is really interesting. I'd never thought of doing that, and in a way it's got a lot to merit it, in terms of explaining it to kids early on and actually framing your energy stores, transfers, what would you call it, categorization, in terms of that would be quite good, because I think kids do struggle with this random collection of eight stores and four transfers.
Because I started running through all the types of energy we used to teach. Well, nuclear, and I think, nuclear. I mean, another thing I talked to Ben about in great depth is how the strong force and the nuclear force work. I mean, and that's just, really, that's just fields and position in the field and shape of the field. And then if you can reduce that to the shape of field, you can reduce anything to kinetic and potential, as in field potential.
Yeah, and no bad thing. That's a very simple way of doing it. I have to think through it. So one of the things I always ask myself is, does it explain mass energy equivalence? Because that's a difficult one. and I'm not sure it. I'm not sure, actually, weirdly, because Ben's a particle physicist, I'm not sure it really does. I'd have to ask Ben how he works with that, because this idea of energy always going to the lowest point. So how on earth do you explain matter, which is an incredible concentration of energy in one place, and yet matter is stable in the universe? You know, protons have half lives of gazillions of years, don't they? So, I'm not sure. It's as with all models in physics, you can find a hole in it, but I think it's an interesting and intriguing proposition.
Well, that's the other thing he talked about, and I would like to do a podcast on it, so I haven't played that bit, which he starts off his talk talking about the power of analogy, we haven't got time to talk about it now. Maybe we'll do that in next week's podcast, but what you're touching on there is exactly what he said, and, you know, every analogy has its weakness.
Yes. That's right, and it's also that's okay. And the idea, I do stress that with kids as well. So I talk about models and analogies a lot with kids, and I do say that we use them as ways to help us understand, and none of them is perfect, and we know that because we don't have all the answers yet. but it's better to have a bad model than no model at all.
Yeah, which is probably a good point to stop, because we've gone in one take. And it's less than half an hour, so that's a great start to the new year.
Cool.
Right, so before we go, we should say thank you for listening, and we should say, if you want to get in touch, because we need some ideas for the coming term, you can email us contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com.
Yes, you can Instagram physics_teaching_podcast.
Twitter @physicsTP. Or every page on our website, the.physicsteachingpodcast.com, has a contact form. And whilst you're there, you could buy a lovely T-shirt and support the podcast.
Yes, you could support our trip to America. But I tell you what, also, if you would like to take part in the podcast, because that's the other thing we were saying, it's a new year, and we don't have a lot on the schedule at the moment, actually. We've got a few people coming up who will be extremely interesting, would be extremely good, but we do have some spaces as well. So if there's something you'd like to talk about, please, please, please do get in touch. We would love to hear from you and just broaden out the number of people who we're talking to on the podcast and get some new ideas and some fresh voices.
Yes, it's not middle-aged white men. It would be great. Thanks, chaps. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Thomas.
Always a good time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast. A special thanks this week to Jonathan Shaw and Dr. Ben Still. The podcast is presented by Robin Griffiths, Patrick Kapler, and me, Thomas W.P., and produced and edited by me, Thomas W.P. Do share your ideas with us. We forgot to mention Facebook when we recorded, and you can just look for the Physics Teaching Podcast in Facebook. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.